Good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for September of 2021. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print impaired audience, but hopefully it will be of interest to everyone. Dates to remember in September begin with Labor Day, which this year falls on the 6th. We think of Labor Day as the end of summer with youngsters back in school and hopefully with milder temperatures. This year, Rosh Hashanah began on sundown on the 6th and ends at sundown on the 8th. Patriots Day is the 11th, followed by Grandparents Day on the 12th. The Star Spangled Banner was written by Francis Scott Key on the 14th in 1814. The United States Constitution was approved on the 17th in 1787. The United States Air Force was established on the 18th in 1947, and the first day of fall or autumn is the 22nd. In the world of business, nothing remains as it was. For example, big beverage companies are shifting their lineups, shedding well-known but less profitable brands to focus on core products and newer lines that appear to be changing consumer tastes. PepsiCo has said it will sell Tropicana and other juice brands to private companies. Nestle has agreed to sell Poland's water bottled water and most of its North American bottled water brands to other water firms. And last year, Coca-Cola discontinued a slew of brands, including Tab Diet Soda, Zico Coconut Water, and Odwalla Fruit Juices and Smoothies. The move signals at least a partial retreat from the industry's primary strategy of late. For years, companies have multiplied their offerings, expanding from soda to coconut water, smoothies, fermented tea, dairy alternatives, and other niche but promising territory. Now the industry is refocusing around a smaller set of categories, including energy drinks, coffee, traditional carbonated soft drinks, said Howard Telford, head of Euromonitor International. The latest shift, like the prior strategies of expansion, reflects an industry trying to satisfy rapidly shifting consumer tastes. Consumption of fruit juices and sugary sodas have fallen as people have lowered their sugar intake in favor of alternatives such as diet soda, flavored seltzer, and bottled water. Meanwhile, a demand is increasing for functional beverages, drinks that help people stay awake or concentrate, for example, or offer a health benefit like an antioxidant. As a result, coffee and energy drinks are on the rise. U.S. retail store sales volume of soda has fallen 10%, and fruit juices sales have declined 16% over the last 10 years, according to Euromonitor International. Over the same period, coffee increased 9%, and energy drinks, still a small category, more than doubled. Companies are taking different tacks in their searches for growth. PepsiCo is leaning into hard energy. Last year, they splashed out $3.85 million on energy drink company Rockstar, and this year it introduced a Mountain Dew-branded energy drink called Mountain Dew Rise. It also recently relaunched Evolve, a plant-based protein drink that was a part of its 2019 acquisition of Cytosport. Clearly, we see that consumers are moving into protein and sport drinks, and that is a space that we like to continue to grow, the CEO Raymond LaGuarta said. Coke has made a big bet on coffee, agreeing in 2018 to buy Costa, a British coffee house chain, for $5.1 billion and rolling out a coffee version of Coca-Cola. However, the company's efforts to expand in energy drinks have stumbled. In May, it pulled the plug on an energy drink version of its namesake cola in the U.S. after less than a year of disappointing sales. Since becoming Coke's CEO in 2017, James Quincy has pushed the company to take risks on new ideas and drop them quickly if they don't work. The company last year went on products that it said were small but weren't growing or didn't have the potential to achieve on a large scale. Coke now says it will strengthen its marketing and innovation to support its streamlined portfolio. By continuously engaging customers and testing ideas in a coordinated way and increasing digital way, we're getting even better at what we've always done best, building loved brands around the world, Mr. Quincy said in a meeting with analysts. Nestle, meanwhile, is focusing on a slimmed-down group of pricier brands after agreeing to sell its lower-margin bottled water for $4.3 billion. Mainstream bottled water has faced stiff competition from cheap store brands, making this category less attractive to Nestle. We have refocused our Nestle's water business to position it for profitable growth from a smaller and more attractive base, said Nestle CEO Mark Schneider. The company is now focusing on its premium mineral water portfolio, which includes Perrier and S. Pellegrino, and expanding into a functional drink such as Essentia, an alkaline water brand that Nestle acquired in March. PAI Partners has agreed to buy a controlling stake in PepsiCo's juice business. PepsiCo will retain a 39% share in the new joint venture. PAI sees growth potential in fruit juices through investment in production, innovation, expansion into other categories, other chilled categories, said Frederick Stevenson, a managing partner at the firm. Still talking about beverages, the price of a cup of coffee keeps rising and no one seems to care. Prices for Arabica beans rose 50% in the past 12 months, hitting a 7-year high in July after drought and frost-damaged crops in the top producer, Brazil, and signaled tight world supplies for at least 2 years. High freight costs, and shipper container shortages continues to rattle supply global chains, squeezing margins and heightening inflation fears. Many a consumer-faced business faces a stock choice. Raise prices or switch to cheaper beans. The good news? Coffee drinkers are so addicted that consumption is unlikely to be hurt much, especially with demand still recovering from the pandemic. The drink is such a key part of a consumer's daily routines. It would take a lot to change their coffee habits, said Daryl Seifer, a food and beverage analyst at research group in the NPD group. Customers are accustomed to volatile prices, he added. This year, coffee consumption is expected to rise to 168.8 million 60-kilogram bags, according to Rabobank International, from 164.8 million bags in the previous year. The world market is expected to expand at a compound annual rate of 9% over the next 3 years to well over $400 billion, Starbucks says. In Asia, the fastest-growing coffee market, consumption will rise thanks to bigger incomes and a growing cafe culture in China, India, and Indonesia, according to Fitch Solutions. Demand for coffee is not completely unshakable. The pandemic brought the first dip since 2011. But while higher prices this year may curb the post-pandemic rebound, consumption won't decrease, Rabobank analysts say. Prices would have to climb above $4 a pound to start making a dent in consumption, according to Sterling Smith, Director of Agricultural Research at AgroSomopo North America. Until then, price-sensitive consumers may cut out cheaper cafes or make more coffee at home, he said. The impact will differ by region, said Venusia Norgueira, Director of Brazilian Specialty Coffee Association. Consumers in producing nations like hers tend to be more price-sensitive, she said, while coffee drinkers in wealthier places like Europe and the United States are less affected. There's already a switch toward cheaper, robusta beans in Brazil, according to Rabobank. For companies like Starbucks, coffee beans represent a small portion of overall costs when compared to labor and rent. Still, the world's largest cafe chain said it's feeling inflationary pressures. Pricing will be one of the many levers we use to offset these headwinds, the company said, as well as encouraging consumers to buy more expensive items like food and drink. Nestle CEO Mark Schneider said premiumization and higher price point give the maker of Nespresso and Nescafe options. where appropriate, will raise prices, he said. Some businesses may try tactics such as fewer refills or reducing the weight of package without changing prices, said Judy Gans, president of J. Gans Consulting. For some smaller coffee shops, charging more may be easier than altering the taste of the loyal visitor's daily cup. Some of our customers have been drinking our blends for many, many years. If we change them, they'll notice it, said Marissa Corsetta, manager at London's Algerian coffee stores, which have been selling coffee since 1887. If raw coffee prices go up dramatically with all of the other costs, then we'll have to increase our price. At home, we use Starbucks, and no more than we use, we'll probably pay the price. For most of the world, the weekend beginning Friday the 13th in Haskins, Nebraska, it was also National Kool-Aid Day. It was there in 1927 that Edmund Perkins invented that sugary beverage now owned by Kraft Heinz. It became the state's official soft drink in 1998 and is celebrated every August. The town embracing its claim to fame isn't surprising, but the fact that Kool-Aid has lasted so long is. Marketed to children in the 1950s, with a jug who burst through walls, it would have a less wholesome association. Actually, drinking Kool-Aid still isn't good for you. Long-term consumption may increase the risk of obesity, diabetes, and even cancer, medical experts say. How do you like your chicken? It seems that Americans aren't the only folks who like chicken. Two stories from the Wall Street Journal tell of sales of stock of chicken processing companies. Brazilian meat packing giant JBS SA said they plan to buy the portion of U.S. chicken processor Pilgrim Pride that it doesn't already own during a boom time for the chicken industry. The proposed offer valued Colorado-based Pilgrims at about $6.5 billion, would fold the company further into JBS's global meat operations and take it private, JBS said. JBS already owns about 80% of Pilgrims. This proposed deal is the second big chicken transaction to be announced. Sanderson Farms Incorporated, the third largest U.S. chicken producer by volume, announced a $4.5 billion deal to sell itself to Cargill Incorporated and Continental Grain Company, which runs their own chicken businesses. Sanderson Farms got its start in 1947 as a farm supply store. Joe Sanderson, the founder's grandson, has been the company's CEO since 1998, combining Sanderson with Georgia-based Wayne Farms, a poultry company owned by Continental, would form a new competitor representing about 15% of U.S. chicken production. Tyson Food leads the industry with about one-fifth, 20% of the U.S. market. Wayne Farms was founded in 1895 as a feed milling company and later expanded into poultry. Continental bought the company in 1981 and in 2015 announced plans for an initial public offering for Wayne Farms, aiming to consolidate smaller private and family-owned companies. Closely held Cargill, a 156-year-old company with 155,000 employees and 70 companies, is one of the world's biggest food supplier. It buys crops, trades sugar and cotton, and processes meat, supplying some of the world's biggest consumer brands and restaurant chains. The Minnesota-based company is a major chicken supplier in Asia and has other poultry operations in Canada, England, and Latin America. U.S. poultry prices have surged this year as restaurants reopen for indoor dining and fast food chains, including McDonald's and Shake Shack, rolled out new crispy chicken sandwiches. Wholesale prices for chicken breasts have roughly doubled since the beginning of the year, and wing prices have climbed to record levels. Pilgrims in late July said it would return to its food service business as more consumers got vaccinated and pandemic-related dining restrictions eased. Its second quarter losses widened, though. Sales rose 29% as demand continues to recover from pandemic lows. Pilgrims, established in 1946, is the second largest U.S. chicken company by volume, running about 30 processing plants across the country with hatcheries, feed mills, and rendering operations. It has been expanding in organic chicken, has acquired other processed meat businesses, including a $952 million deal proposed in June for the United Kingdom and Ireland meat business of the Kerry Consumer Foods. After nearly 10 years, Saltbox Seafood Joint in Durham is retiring its original location, a 205-square-foot shack that's fried up some of the most beloved seafood in the South. Saltbox owner Ricky Moore said the lease at the 608 North Mangum Street location is set to expire and won't be extended. A second Saltbox location, which Mr. Moore opened in 2017 at 2637 Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard in Durham's Rockwood neighborhood, will remain open. Mr. Moore said, "It isn't going anywhere. I own the concrete. I own the rocks. Nothing's going to happen." With Mr. Moore doing the frying and the cashier taking orders, Saltbox opened in 2012. Mr. Moore was two decades into a restaurant career that included the Culinary Institute of America, some of the finest kitchens in New York City, and chef jobs in the Triangle. In Saltbox, Mr. Moore worked with coastal fishermen and showcased the bounty of North Carolina's waters, familiar seafood like shrimp, oysters, and catfish, and flavorful catches like mullet, grouper, croakers, and bluefish. It wasn't a typical fried fish joint. The fish was barely breaded and heavily seasoned, with sandwiches topped with slaw. Downtown diners sat out at picnic tables and imagined they were near the sea. Saltbox, my apprenticeship in entrepreneurship, he said. I was 20 years in the restaurant business, and going back in the fish kitchen at the Culinary Institute of America and preparing fish, it was fun. It was like a huge project I brought to life, and it flourished. Whenever a national magazine or website would shine on Durham's culinary scene, Saltbox usually was mentioned. Over years, the tiny Saltbox shack served a living story of North Carolina and Mr. Moore's upbringing in eastern North Carolina. "I rooted the shack and fertilized," he said. "I planted a lot of seeds, and things were sown." The shack's view of downtown Durham changed over the past 10 years as the city grew. The skyline gradually studded with taller buildings, apartment complexes, and condos. Mr. Moore says he doesn't know what the future plans for the quarter-acre plot, but imagines a development project will likely find a home there. "It'll probably be some sort of a condo. Who knows," he said. "I'll make one request. Make sure this is called Saltbox Hills." The last service at the original Saltbox joint will begin at noon on August the 22nd and continue until all the shrimp burgers are gone. Like Saltbox's other special meals, like the once-a-year lobster rolls and Grab Grits days, expect a line and a sellout. Mr. Moore said he's picked shrimp burgers for the final Saltbox meal because it's something he's never served before. It also ties to an earlier food memory of his growing up in New Bern and driving with his friend to Ell's Drive-In on prom night and ordering shrimp burgers. It's an appropriate send-off for those who knew eastern North Carolina culture, Mr. Moore said. It's a remembrance meal. Jay Betsky's, one of the few restaurants in the Triangle serving German and Polish cuisine, will close in late August after 15 years in Raleigh's Seaboard Station. The restaurant, owned by John and Catherine Korzewinski, planned to close August 23rd, but it's not retirement, as the owners plan to move and a new concept opening later this year. "We're sad to see this go," Mr. K said, "but once we walk into the new place, we'll forge a new path that hopefully will last another 10 to 20 years. This move is largely driven by the remaking of Seaboard Station," he said, "which is seeing massive redevelopment along Peace Street." The J. Besky's owners plan to open a more casual concept this fall in Raleigh's High Park Village off of Whitaker Mill Road, about 2.5 miles from the current location. Instead of moving with the name, the new concept will be called JB's, a nickname Mr. K says involves the more casual aim. "It will serve similar cuisine, but as a new modernized version," he said. "It should be exciting. Small plates, grab and go, This is the way people are dining now. We hope to have a little something for everyone. Jay Biskey's opened in 2006 and was routinely named one of the stars of the Triangle dining scene, according to former A&O dining critic Craig Cox, who gave it among his highest ratings ever. The restaurant's fine dining take on Austrian, German, and Polish dishes, including schnitzel, sausages, and pierogies. When Jay Biskey's was built, the Kowinskis and the restaurant opening team helped put the dining room together, tiling the floors and staining the wood. It really was an extraordinary effort, Mr. K said. It took a lot of elbow grease. It's a bit weird. We thought it would be built for however long we owned the restaurant. The name J. Biskey's made up a combination of family relationships that ended up christening the long-loved restaurant. The J stands for John, Bet for Elizabeth, John's grandmother, who everybody called Betty, and Ski, the last symbol of the family's name. The Seaboard Station property is in the midst of a $300 million redevelopment, one of downtown Raleigh's latest real estate projects, as Washington developer Hoffman Association plans to add 650 new apartments, 130 square feet of retail space, and a new hotel. The redevelopment has already meant the closing of Sunflowers Cafe and 18 Seaboard. The first phase is not yet sent the wrecking ball into Jay Biskey's, but Mr. K said it's only a matter of time. The building will be gone in no more than 2 years. That's one of the main things factoring into the decision to move. We're looking forward to being in a stable location, not too from our original base. Mr. K says the pandemic was extraordinarily difficult for Jay Biskey's, navigating the pivot from 16 years of dinner service to suddenly most to-go orders. But the lessons will carry over into the new space, which include more prepared foods. We had to move to grab and go, he said. We learned that what traveled well into people's homes, and it saved us. It kept our ship above water. I'm grateful we made it through and still have this opportunity. Best wishes in your new place of business, John and Catherine. Sprinkles at sunset, a cone with a view. Orange County's Mapleview Farm served up one of Triangle's most beloved scoops of ice cream. On August 19th, Mapleview Farm announced that the farm near Chapel Hill would be shutting down and the milk that made the famous ice cream would be no more. But while the farm is closing, ice cream will remain, Mapleview owners say. The milk will come from elsewhere. After 25 years in milk production, Mapleview Farm and Milk Company are closing their doors, as the farm owner said in a Facebook post. It's a very hard decision for both Roger Nutter and Mike Stroud, in which they have decided together. The last day of bottling milk will be Monday, September the 6th, 2021. The cattle will be going to a good home and will be missed immediately. We thank all of our customers, friends, and family that have supported us day in and day out. The milk company asks customers to return any glass bottles by September the 20th. Mapleview's roots began in Maine, where the Nutter family had been farmers for generations. But in 1963, the bitter Maine winters convinced Bob Nutter to move the farms and herds to North Carolina. The farm was a typical dairy farm until 1996, when the family formed Mapleview Milk Company, going the rare route of bottling milk for consumers. That milk could be found in specialty grocery stores throughout the Triangle and in the company's country store. Bob Nutter passed away in 2018, and Mapleview continued under his son Ron and Mr. Stroud. Though the milk company and farm will close, the ice cream shop and the country store will remain open. The ice cream shop has become one of the Triangle's most popular activities in the summer, as crowds wind through the rural roads and enjoy a cone on the porch. All that will remain the same, Mapleview owners say, but the milk for the ice cream will come from Aiden's Simply Natural Creamery. The owner said Simply Natural previously supplied milk for Mapleview after the farm recovered from a fire. Mapleview's Agriculture Center will also remain open, offering classes and training for the next generation of farmers. Our deepest gratitude to the Mapleview Farm Milk Company and Maple View team for their tireless hard work, dedication, and devoted service in providing us with our ice cream base and products for over 20 years, the owner said on a Facebook. Home delivery milk seems to be a thing of the past. As an indicator of people venturing out to eat more is a report from Chipotle Mexican Grill showing that sales for June of the year passed the sales figures for the same period before the pandemic. It's pretty amazing to see how quickly the customer showed up, said Chipotle's CEO, Brian Nicole. Investors are closely watching whether consumers are returning to restaurants amid inflationary pressures that have made going out to eat more costly and possibly hesitantly related to the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19. Chipotle raised its menu prices by about 4% earlier this year, but the chain said it hasn't seen possible pushback from customers from the price increases. The increase helped cover higher wages for workers, the company said. The burrito chain was considered by some analysts to be a pandemic winner given its investment in delivery and online ordering before the virus's surge. Online orders now account for nearly half of the company's sales. However, they've reopened all of its dining rooms. Chipotle plans to build at least 300 new restaurants this year and has repeated a long-term goal of 6,000 locations across North Carolina, North America. Surveys show that many consumers are ready to eat out again. Their sales dropped earlier in the pandemic, but its ability to keep selling food to go helped buffer it from steeper losses experienced by sit-down restaurants. The higher menu prices helped pay for wages, which Chipotle raised to $15 an hour to hire scarce workers in the next few months. Other fast food chains have also announced increased business. McDonald's said its sales are surpassing pre-pandemic levels across the world as more of its dining rooms reopen and U.S. customers try new chicken offerings. The burger giant reported that sales for the quarter ending June were 7% higher than for the same period of 2018 before the pandemic occurred. The company said that menu price increases of roughly 6% over the past year, largely to-go orders and sales of its new crispy chicken sandwiches. In the U.S., 70% of the chain's dining rooms are open. They hope to resume dine-in service in the remaining restaurants by Labor Day, though getting enough staff to do that is challenging. The company said, "We're working hard to get back to normal," CEO Chris Krempczinski said in a conference call. All of these plans are up in the air as food companies digest the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention new guidance about vaccinated people should wear masks in certain parts of the country. McDonald's said that the Delta variant of COVID-19 is contributing to stops and starts in recovery around the world. Busy drive-throughs and online sales have boosted McDonald's and other fast food chains during the pandemic. We've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138.